You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me Alistair McLeod. He's been a fairly frequent guest here, I think probably next to Michael Oliver, the most frequent guest probably, and well, it's because I just enjoy his insights. I read his material at goldmoney.com, where he publishes once a week very thoughtful and insightful insights about the markets, about what's going on, connecting geopolitics with the markets to a great extent. And he has quite a background as an analyst, as a stockbroker, and he understands what honest money is, real money, gold. And so that is one of the main reasons that Alistair is invited on this show, and we're so grateful that he agrees to join us so often from what is getting close to his bedtime in England. Thank you for joining me, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
Well, it is so much fun listening to you. I wouldn't say maybe fun is the wrong word, because a lot of the things you have to say are not necessarily fun, but they are realistic, I think, and truthful. And truth is what we seek on this show as much as anything else. We'd like to make some money from understanding the world as it is. China has risen very rapidly from what was known when I was a young person as a sleeping giant back in the day when Nixon was president, and he sort of opened things up with China during that time. But now China is growing very rapidly. Their economy is growing, and with their economy, they're building up their military to a certain extent. They're building infrastructure that is challenging America, American trade, and hegemony, I would say, in parts of the world, especially in Asia. I'm wondering if you could comment on China's rise to become such a global power in a relatively short period of time, in a few decades. You know, from the days of Mao Zedong, when it was sort of an internal organism that didn't do much or talk to the rest of the world until it is now. How did China achieve such a rapid climb?
Well, basically, they follow, if you like, Confucian principles, which basically we would call mercantilist, where the state runs the economy as if it was a business. Mm-hmm. And after Mao died, around about 1982, round about then, they began to encourage Western businesses to set up manufacturing capabilities on the mainland. And this meant there was a lot of inward investment. So at that time, there was a trade deficit because of the inward investment. But that was quite rapidly overtaken by production. China became, if you like, the source of cheap goods for the world and obviously America. Really growing from there, she's now entered a new phase, and that is she has lifted a lot of her population from subsistence level farming into sort of lower and middle classes. And the middle classes are growing quite rapidly, and that's what a lot of the development is about. So the economy is now moving from exporting cheap stuff to countries like America and Europe and Britain and so on, into providing the services and higher quality goods and technology for her own citizens. So it's a very big change in emphasis. But when you look at the rate at which the Chinese economy is growing, of course, the measure is GDP, and the GDP is just a money total. So in a sense, when you see that the Chinese economy is growing at 10% year after year, or 6% or whatever it is, it's really a function of the expansion of bank credit. And of course, we all know that that can only go so far. But what they're now doing is they're trying to jump down on the speculative the consequences of the expansion of bank credit. I mean, for example, traders who try and front run the state when it comes to buying commodities, Mm-hmm. You find that what happens is that the Chinese government start leaning on the shadow banking system, and the shadow banks then have to withdraw from facilities from the speculators. So you find that, hey presto, we've got copper going down, we've got nickel going down, we've got lead going down, we've got silver going down. So these, I would hesitate to call silver a base metal, but basically that base metal complex is shaking out the Chinese speculators, as it were. And this is as a result of monetary policy within China. But that will change because China has really more or less cornered the global market for infrastructure materials, because she is going to be building her electricity grid. She is going to be building new rail communications, all those things which require huge amounts of copper. And on top of that, she's looking to industrialize her own backyard. And we're looking really at virtually all Asia. And the consequences for Europe are also very important, because with the new Silk Road, trains are now delivering huge quantities of goods in both directions. And at the moment, it takes something like 12 days to get from get a Mercedes car, say, from Stuttgart into the showroom in Beijing, just 12 days. Whereas if it went by sea, you would be looking at 30 days. Mm-hmm. So you can see that this is a huge change in the way everything is done and everything is happening. And, of course, part of this is that China wants effectively to run her own affairs in the global context as much as possible. And this is why she doesn't want to use the dollar. She's seen America use the dollar as a weapon, if you like, against other nations. And she doesn't want to be in the position of weakness where America might do that. So this is really her driving motivation for getting her trade partners to accept yuan. And I would just add one little point here, which is, I think, missed by everybody. And that is that over the last year, the yuan has been a better currency to take payment than the dollar. And this is very, very important. And I think it is encouraging, particularly the oil exporters to China, to take yuan rather than oil. And this, of course, has implications for the petrodollar and the way the world has operated on a dollar reserve basis and with the major commodities all priced in dollars ever since the early 1970s. So it's an interesting juncture, I think, this point in China's development and how it is affecting the world as a whole.
Could you explain, perhaps, Alistair, how the reserve currency that the U.S. has had, which I think was what was orchestrated during Nixon's day, the petrodollar, was the petroleum-backed the dollar in a sense, where when he took away gold from the international monetary system, and then Kissinger sets out to work a deal with Saudi Arabia and the oil producers, demanding dollars for payment of oil. And now, as you've talked about on this show before, China is the largest importer of oil now, and they're saying, you know, we're not going to give you dollars, we're going to give you yuan. And but how does the United States, or how has the United States used its currency to get over on other countries and perhaps take advantage of them? How does it work that? How does it do that?
Well, the way it works is that, as you probably know, if I, as someone living in the UK, have a dollar balance, I might have the dollar balance through my bank account, but actually the dollar balance is in New York. It's not mm-hmm. here. And so if I need dollars in order to do trade settlements, then I have to buy my dollars in order to do it. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't take the dollars away from New York. What it does is it expands the quantity of dollars within the American banking system. So you can see that it costs absolutely nothing for the Fed to provide me with dollars, but at the same time, it allows the Fed to expand the quantity of dollars in circulation in the U.S. banking system. So really what happens is that you've got this sort of dichotomy, as it were. On the one hand, I'm in the market having to buy dollars so that I can go and buy oil or whatever it is that I want to buy. On the other hand, you can run your economy as badly as you like over there, but I still need the damn dollars. So this was the point, I think, behind the Triffin dilemma, because what Robert Triffin, who was a Belgian American economist, sort of 30, 40 years ago, what he understood was that by being the reserve currency, what the dollar was doing was it was able to overvalue its currency because of international demand, and at the same time run its economy on a basis that would otherwise undermine the economy. And it's for this reason that you have had the most enormous balance of payments deficits for some considerable time without it affecting the dollar. That's it's all slightly counterintuitive, but that is the way in which the exorbitant privilege, if you like, of the dollar actually works.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a very large build-up of dollars in foreign hands. And funnily enough, this is the subject of an article which will be released later on this week.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting. We'll look forward to that for sure. But you're saying that the Chinese currency has outperformed the dollar. So people who sold oil to China would have been better off taking yuan over the last year than dollars, eh? And that's without exchanging their yuan for gold.
That is correct, yes. The yuan is up about 9% over 2017 against the dollar. So that's the extent to which you would have benefited.
So now we have this. Can you comment a little bit on the Shanghai Oil Exchange, the futures exchange? It just opened, I believe it was March 26th when it went live. Is that right? And how is it performing?
Yes, you're right. It went live on March the 26th, and the first week's trading has been very successful. In the first 3 days, the equivalent of 60 million barrels of oil were traded. And given that China's daily intake, if you like, import of oil is around about 8 to 8.5 million barrels, you can see that the size of the market looks like developing into having sufficient liquidity, really, for China to settle all her her oil imports convincingly in her own currency. The thing that's interesting about this is that there are some nations who export to China who would also like to avoid the dollar. So they're on the same page, as it were, as China is when it comes to not wanting to use the dollar. The principal ones, obviously, are Iran and also Russia. Russia is now the largest exporter of oil around the world, having overtaken Saudi Arabia, just. Iran sells a lot of oil to China. And we can see particularly those two nations who we know like gold, they use gold as money, they are likely to, if you like, use the futures markets for to hedge some of their yuan exposure into matching gold contracts. Now, there are yuan gold contracts traded in both Hong Kong and also Dubai. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, the Chinese authorities appear to have given the blessing to an arrangement between Dubai and Hong Kong, and they've also brought in other centres like Singapore. They're talking, believe it or not, to Myanmar, you know, the old Burma, mm-hmm. And also possibly Cambodia. What mm. they're looking to do is to set up what's being described as a gold corridor. Mm-hmm. What these centres, particularly Dubai and Hong Kong, see is increased demand for deliverable gold futures. Now, they're tagging it as being the result of the Silk Road project and the amount of business that's likely to come into the futures market as a byproduct of that. But actually what they're doing is they're looking to gear up within 2 or 3 months to have storage facilities, which they've already contracted for, on the Chinese mainland. so that there is a depot, if you like, for physical gold to be deposited and delivered with these contracts. So I think the very fact that two rival exchanges are getting together basically tells me, and I think it tells the world, that they see, as a result of the development on the energy contracts in Shanghai, there is likely to be a greater demand for gold. They need to get together in order to be able to satisfy it. So it is a double blow, if you like, as far as the Americans are concerned. On the one hand, the petrodollar is no longer being exclusively used, and there's not a lot America can do about it. And on the other hand, it would appear that some of the users of this contract are likely to hedge into gold and could end up driving the gold price up, which, as far as the American Treasury are concerned and the Fed are concerned, is a development they would not want to see.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, this is a direct competition against the dollar hegemony, and to a certain extent, if a good part of the world isn't using dollars anymore, that privilege ceases to exist to the same extent it did before anyway. And you're saying there's not much that can be done about it, and yet I'm hearing growing rhetoric here in the United States all the time about how China is a bigger and bigger threat to us, and how we need to flex our military muscles in order to try to resolve this threat. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, certainly you over there on your side of the pond, the Brits are pretty much with us on this, or at least the public officials seem to be. What are your thoughts about that? And in fact, I'd like to ask you about another article you recently wrote, The End of Democracy, and you're suggesting that these, if I got you right, these growing geopolitical tensions are probably going to impact us negatively in terms of the democracy that we in the West have enjoyed for so many years.
Well, I'll come to democracy in a moment. That is, if you like, I'm afraid a continuing miserable story. But yeah. Getting back to your basic point about the increase in tensions between America and China, mm-hmm. Yes, that is certainly the case. And I think the reason that the Chinese have taken so long to introduce this contract is they have been concerned about the effects on the dollar that might follow. Because remember, they are very large holders of U.S. treasuries, apart from anything else. The other thing is that the trade relationship with America is a very, very delicate thing. I think when President Trump got elected, it did rather change things as far as China was concerned, because they see him, I think, as a bit of a bull in the China shop rather than a subtle operator. Mm-hmm. And consequently, I think that the Chinese got themselves into a position whereby they really had to go ahead with this contract, because the very fact that they were insisting as much as possible that their oil suppliers take yuan meant that they had to provide the, if you like, the financial depth for people like Russia to really seriously consider this and use it going forward. So they lost, I think, a little bit of the timing in terms of control over the timing as to when mm-hmm. this contract was going to go out. It had to go out. The problem, I think, as far as America is concerned, is America did not want to see this contract because of the petrodollar issue. Mm-hmm. The fact that it has gone ahead, I think, has increased trade tensions. And I don't think it's an accident that President Trump started off immediately after the start of this contract was announced, before it actually started trading, with tariffs on steel and aluminium. Mm-hmm. And that has obviously continued and gone into other products as well. China has hit back with tariffs the other way. And so you've got this sort of tit for tat thing going. This, I think, was inevitable. But I think that the thing that has set the timing of it has actually been the introduction of this contract because of that petrodollar angle.
All right. Alistair, unfortunately, we're going to have to let it go there. I hear a discussion in the future about trade wars with you. And as far as the demise of democracy goes, I would just suggest that people go to goldmoney.com, and read that article, and also sign up and get on the mailing list to receive Alistair's weekly missives, or go to goldmoney.com. com to read what he has to say, because they are very insightful, very helpful, and very practical in terms of how we view our investments, I think, going forward. Thank you so much again, Alistair, for being with us, and always a pleasure. I hope we can have you back again sometime soon. Folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, former Congressman Ron Paul, presidential candidate, will be with us to talk about, I think, some of the same topics that we just talked to Alistair about. I'm sure you're not going to want to miss next week with Dr. Ron Paul. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bonterra Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Auren Resources is a technically driven, capital-efficient exploration company focused on delivering shareholder value through accretive project acquisition and discovery. The company's management team has a record of success in the discovery, advancement, and monetization of exploration assets. Auren's focus is on advancing its 7 premier gold exploration projects located in Canada and Peru. Auren's shares trade on the TSX in Canada and the NYSE American in the U.S. under the stock symbol AUG. For more information, please visit AurenResources.com.